Welcome to episode 37 of The Climate Champions. I'm Lee Krivat, and each week I publish a new episode with a new climate champion as my guest. This week's guest is Neil Kermode, Managing Director at EMEC, the European Marine Energy Center on the Orkney Islands in Scotland. If you or someone you know is a climate champion, please let me know at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com. Established in 2003, EMEC is the first and only center of its kind in the world, providing developers of both wave and tidal energy converters, that's technologies that generate electricity by harnessing the power of waves and tidal streams, with purpose-built, accredited open sea testing facilities. Orkney is an ideal base for EMEC, with its unrivaled oceanic wave regime, strong tidal currents, grid connection, sheltered harbored facilities, and the renewable maritime and environmental expertise that exists within the local community. Over the next month, please don't miss some of the exciting guests I'll have on the Climate Champions, including Michelle Brechtelsbauer, Director of Stakeholder Relations at the Energy Impact Center, Catherine Hamilton, co-founder and chair at 38 North Solutions and co-host of the Energy Gang podcast, and Vince Cerf, Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist at Google and also recognized as one of the fathers of the Internet. Neil has been the managing director of EMEC since 2005. He oversees the company's operational, environmental, financial, and commercial performance. Prior to working at EMEC, Neil worked as a project developer of a potential tidal scheme that attempted to leverage the big difference in sea level on the North Sea and the Scapa Flow sides of the four wartime causeways known as the Churchill Barriers. Neil is a chartered engineer, a fellow of the Institution of Civil Engineers, and a chartered environmentalist. He is a passionate advocate for a sustainable energy future. Welcome to Climate Champions. This is Lee Krivat. I am on the Orkney Islands with Neil Kermode, Managing Director at EMEC, which is the European Marine Energy Center, where they focus on wave and tidal energy. Neil, welcome to Climate Champions.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
Yeah, no, it's really my pleasure. With regard to climate change, can you talk about a motivating moment when you first decided you wanted to engage in mitigating climate change?
I think it really came from being interested in wanting to do something about renewable energy, or alternative energy as it was called in those days here in the UK. And that was really a TV program that was on. It was a thing called House for the Future. And it was something we caught on a Sunday afternoon after we had the family lunch. And we sit down for a cup of tea in the afternoon and this program was on. And it was about a young family who were moving into an old house that they were renovating to make it fit for the 20th century in those days, because that must have been back about 1976, something like that.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. And in the program, they covered, each week they covered a different part of renovating a house to be green. And one of the things was about a wind turbine, and one of them was about solar. And it was very old form of solar, trickling water across a roof rather than anything we do today. And that was about insulation. And all of these things were woven together by a story about how we really need to sort our energy picture out. And that was, you know, in the late 70s. And I got really interested in that. And that, I think, was a big changing moment for me at school. And that directed, to a large extent, how I've lived since. I built my own wind turbine when I was at school. It blew to pieces in the storm. We never did find the second blade. But it was one of those things that really set me realizing it was important. Now, at that time, it wasn't really about climate change. It was just about the stupidity of wasting energy. And at this time, the UK had gone through the first oil shocks, and we'd ended up with no electricity for 3 days a week. So we had rolling blackouts. And so I'd done a lot of my school homework at one point by candlelight because there was no electricity. And so I think it must have sensitized me to energy at that sort of age when it was very formative. And over time, this drive to make sure the energy side of things is right has become evident through a climatic impact rather than just an efficiency impact. And now we're seeing that the renewables is really the way that we're going to get ourselves out of this dead end that we've worked ourselves into.
So not only to remove the carbon, but I think it's a good point to make that there's energy independence involved. Yeah. You can separate from the grid. You don't have to be dependent on anybody else for your energy.
Well, yes, I think that was characteristic at the time. People were talking about self-sufficiency in energy. But actually, the more you see the energy picture as a whole, the harder you realize self-sufficiency is, and it's better to trade energy in and out of the grid, store what you can. It's like trying to grow all your own food. You can if you really want to, but actually it's better to grow some of your own food and then work hard to buy the other stuff. But as long as you're trading it, then that can work. So I don't think it's about self-sufficiency. I think the argument has moved to energy efficiency and minimizing the loss of income by buying energy off other people, make what you can. But to store all of your energy that you need would require some really big tech.
Yes, it gets into the idea of 100% of the time, but it's nice that if you have an emergency, you can survive on your own.
Oh, yeah.
And if the cost of connecting to a grid is less expensive than making 100%, then I would definitely connect.
Yes, and it's finding that spot that's right for you in those conditions. And indeed, some places, some of the things we're doing, we'll talk about more later, but often that's around working in communities which have got limited capacity to generate. So it's an island of some type, or it's a fairly big island, or a small community on the edge of a big continent that's not connected to a grid. They don't have some choices in some of this stuff. And so we're seeing it's not just on an individual basis, it's actually a community, or indeed a large community, we are trying to help with the work we're doing here.
Why is mitigating climate change personally important to you?
I think it goes back to probably the Apollo 8 Earthrise photographs. Because you realize from those photographs taken by the Apollo guys there that, you know, it is a very finite resource we have. And we really can't afford to screw this up. And so it's just the planet is so fragile in so many respects that we have a responsibility to make sure that we don't make it uninhabitable for all the other creatures that are around here. So we have a role, we have a place to play on this, but we have no right to make it uninhabitable for others.
Especially with my visit to the Orkney Islands, I'm realizing just how fragile it is. Mm. But because the fragility isn't seen immediately, I think it's difficult for a lot of people to realize that it's fragile and that we can mess it up.
I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. I mean, if we could see carbon dioxide, we probably would have done something about it before. Now, we did this with smoke when we had problems in the 40s, when a lot of people had open fires in London and the cities, but the pall of smoke over the cities became so thick that it became a health issue and people dealt with it. We had the same thing back in the 19th century when there was too much sewage in our rivers that they smelt and therefore it was a problem. Now, in the act of getting rid of the sewage, it makes the rivers more habitable for fish. But the real driver was it was human health that drove us to do something. And I think probably now we're in that same position where very selfishly, but for the right outcome, we are now realising if we don't sort this out, the planet will sort us out. So I think we're driven very much now by a recognition that there is a problem and we have to deal with it.
I went to the village, Scarabray, and there was some thought that the reason the people had to move was because the tides changed in some way that took their fresh water and made it salt water. Mm-hmm. And so they had to retreat and find new fresh water. So it seems to me that humans have always been able to adapt because they can always find somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that it wasn't easy for them to abandon their village when they did that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, there must have been huge emotional ties to the place, and the abandonment is difficult. But the I suppose the principal difference, I mean, that is a Stone Age village, 5,000 years old. There are 10 houses that are there in a cluster, but they were occupied over about 600 years at different stages. But eventually, as you say, it was abandoned. But the point was there was space for them to move somewhere else. We are getting to a point where there isn't much space to go move somewhere else to. And it's getting kind of crowded. So we've got to start running from our problems and fix them where we are.
And we think there was somewhere for them to go. But we also know that this area of Scotland had a lot of war, had a lot of invasions where people fought over territory to try to find new places that were better to live. And that is something that could potentially happen to us.
I think it's almost inevitable, regrettably. You know, it doesn't really matter where you draw the line in terms of the population numbers that are sustainable. If you go above that, you've got a problem. You know, so at the moment, we are 6 billion, 6.5. I've lost track now, but it's a lot. You know, the population has doubled in my lifetime. Now, that's going to lead to an interesting outcome. Personally, I think we have a responsibility to make sure we can live with as light a footprint as possible to enable people to survive in such a way that means that we don't end up with conflict and people fighting over resources. Certainly the history of the UK is that we have sought resources from other countries around the world at various times. And that, most recently, has really been oil and gas. And we've seen some of the instabilities that that has then created. So, if you can therefore make your energy here, it means you don't have to go and take it from somebody else. So, you know, that's got to lead to a more stable and more equitable style.
Even beyond climate change?
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of climate change, when you meet people that don't believe there is climate change, how do you explain to them that there is and that it's important and urgent that we do something about it?
See, that's an interesting question about belief. And I think it's gone beyond belief, and it's now very much more a scientific.
I can't even believe I said that, because it shouldn't be about believing. It's like you don't believe 2 + 2 = 4.
Yeah.
It just is.
Yeah, and frankly, whether somebody else believes it will not change the science. So your failure to believe something doesn't mean it's not going to happen. It's just you might not understand it when it does happen. So we find it's about putting good science in front of people, and we remind people of the fact that, you know, we've just passed through 410 parts per million. When I was born, it was about 330 parts per million. I'm 60 years old. You know, that's a huge increase in just a lifetime. So we do remind people about the context in which these things are becoming evident. We also, to some extent, we try and push very much on the basis that what we're trying to do with marine energy, of harvesting the energy from the waves and the tides, is absolutely a good economic thing to do anyway. It's a new industry that's going to be created that will enable people in often remote communities to harvest energy from their own coastlines and save sending a large amount of money to the man for oil and gas, you know, to make it a local thing. There are enough compelling arguments that mean this is the right thing to do anyway. And climate change is a piece of that argument. But actually, there's enough good reasons to do it now.
Have you ever had an experience where you changed somebody's mind?
Oh, I hope so. I'm sure we have. But to some extent, I think one of the things that we have been able to do is be something of a rallying point for people who think this is important and want to do something. The company now has got around 50 employees. I can think of 3 of them who have left the oil and gas sector to come and work in what we're doing because they just didn't feel comfortable doing what they were doing in the oil and gas sector. They just had had enough and thought, I just need to do something else. And it wasn't just running away from, you know, a particular boss or an employee. It was very much a choice about the direction they wanted their lives to go. And they wanted to do something that's positive and is absolutely sustainable. So I think what we've done is provide them with an opportunity to contribute to something which we know is important, a mission which we know has got relevance and is, frankly, critical.
I had a teacher, Ernie Seligman, back when I was in high school, which was a long time ago. We are talking about 1979, 1980. And he said that he saw students of the age when there was the Vietnam War protesting about something and how much it mattered to them, but that in the current time, there wasn't that kind of movement afoot for people to get engaged with, to think beyond themselves. And I think that in the U.S., we have gun violence, for example, where students are very engaged in thinking beyond themselves and about the problem. But climate change, I think, is that mission now for people that want to fight for something.
I'm sure you're right. I mean, we've got a variety of things that are happening in the UK. So like the school strike, which really started from Greta Thunberg in Sweden, of school children taking a Friday off and going to protest about doing things about the climate. And we've had protests here, and fair play to them. These young people are deciding that they need to express how they feel about stuff, and they're angry. They're damned angry, and good, because that anger can be directed into actual positive change. I mean, they're angry, but they're not violent with it. So they are just determined, and we have to do something. And that is ending up with people who might not otherwise listen being willing to consider making changes. So we've had this climate emergency declaration, which has happened in a number of places around the world. But it has gone through from the Scottish government making a declaration about this being an emergency, local councils in various areas around the country doing it, individual groups declaring this. And the point is that then allows people to brigade the actions that they need to take and get it under a banner and make them part of a program. So one small person's protest or one small person's change of what they're doing feels a little bit pointless and insignificant or trivial. But if, you know, 1,000 people are doing it, or you're part of a group of people who are doing it across the planet, you feel empowered to take further steps. And the history of change is absolutely driven by groups of people getting together and going, this is just not on, we'd stop. There's a very good book by Naomi Klein, This Changes Everything. And one of the bits in there, and I'm paraphrasing it effectively, says that there's always been a history of major change coming from the grassroots. So a point is that slavery was never a problem in the UK until we decided slavery was a problem in the UK. And at that point, people saw it, recognised that what was going on was simply morally wrong, and forced people to make change. Now, it happens at a time when there's often a political willingness and a readiness to do something, but there has to be that social dimension where people are ready for change. It feels as though something like that is happening now.
I mentioned before that you are the managing director of EMEC, European Marine and Energy Centre. Do you want to talk about what you do?
Yes, that's a good idea. We could do that. Yes, I've gone off on one, haven't I? So EMEC was set up back in 2003, which was as a result of some work that was done by government that looked at the future of the seas in the UK back in 1999. And it looked at shipping and dredging and offshore oil and gas and a whole load of things. And it effectively mentioned that marine energy could be a thing that's coming at some stage. And that gave rise to some work being done which drew some maps which showed where the resources are. So how much energy is in the waves, in different parts of the country. And a map was drawn. And where are the strong tides that could be harnessed? And those maps really showed that Scotland had got a lot of this energy. So big waves come pounding into our coast in Scotland, driven by the winds across the North Atlantic and the spin of the earth, meaning that, you know, west-facing coasts get more energy. And those together really woke up part of our local government system here, our regional development agency, an organisation called Highlands and Islands Enterprise. And they realised that, in fact, there was an opportunity to build a test centre which would help bring these ideas for machines, for harvesting energy from waves and tides. It would help get those machines into the water. Because it's hard to build a machine and find a site to put it in and put the cable in and negotiate with everybody and get the consents and find a grid connection. There's a load of stuff. So it was realised that if we did a lot of that back office stuff, then people like yourself could come along with an idea for a wave machine and just plug it on the end of a cable. It's all good to go. And you can learn your art and make your machine work well. And we'll do a lot of the dull back office stuff. So that was the model that was set up. And in 2003, eMAC was created. In 2004, we opened our doors when an organisation called Ocean Power Delivery brought their first wave energy machine along. And that would look like a five-carriage train. And you know how when a train goes around a bend, the carriages flex relative to each other. Well, it's the same sort of thing, but this train floats on the surface of the water. And as the waves go underneath it, so the carriages flex as the waves pass underneath the different
very
carriages.
Very nice, very nice.
And that was the first idea that was there. And they brought their machine and they generated into the national grid from that machine. And that was the first time anybody had ever generated from deep water wave anywhere in the world. And then over time, the company started to work on other things like tidal energy, which is effectively a bit like an underwater wind turbine, is the best way to think of it. And that wind turbine is either on the seabed sticking up into the water column and the water rushes past it and turns the blades, or else it's hanging down from the underside of a ship or some sort of floating structure and doing the same sort of thing. And they started work on that. And about that time, I joined the company in 2005. And so since then, we've now had, I think it's 31 different devices that we've tested here of different machines. They've been from, I think, 11 different countries, I think it is at the moment. And just next door to us, in this room, we've got a Spanish company working on their turbine here at the moment, which is up in Orkney, generating. And we've had a number of really great successes, but that has then led to a lot of other things. So we, as a result of what we're doing with generating energy from the tides, it's caused us to have to look at if the grid is working as best it can. And we're looking at storage. We're now making hydrogen to power ferries. And it's led to a whole load of other things that are going on. But when we started, it was very much small-scale pieces of R&D activity, research and development activity. But over time, those companies, some have succeeded, some have failed, some have really matured. And I think last year was one of the really big moments for the company, and certainly for me. And that was a company called Orbital Marine Power, a little local company. In fact, they're building just across the road by the big wind turbine over the road. And they built a machine, a 2-megawatt tidal turbine. And that generated really well during last year. It was out at sea for over a year. And during last summer, it was generating about 7% of Orkney's electricity. 7%. So that means that's about a day a fortnight, these islands were effectively running on tidal energy. Now that's just brilliant.
So where do you see the cost of a megawatt hour getting to?
Well, it's got to get competitive.
Sure.
So that's where it's got to get to. Is it there at the moment? No, not really, but it's heading that way. But at the moment, we have to recognise we've only really got the first machines in the water. It's difficult to really prove your costs, but we can see what they are at the moment. We can see how they're going to come down. And the thing is, costs come down when people practice. The more of this you do, the better you get. It's just a law of human nature that the more we practice, the better we get. And so we can see that these costs could be getting down to offshore wind prices, £50-60 a megawatt hour. It depends. We're probably £200 a megawatt hour at the moment because it's R&D. It's the first machine. You know? We keep saying, how good was Henry Ford's second car? I wouldn't buy it. Well, I might buy it for a museum, but I wouldn't drive it on the freeways. But you had to have the second car to have the third car for there to be the 20th million car. You've got to go on that journey. We are trying to help people go on that journey by making it as easy as possible to get their machines into the water. And then they can then concentrate on making their machines work. And then we help as many ways as we can through talking to government, helping to get people interested in what's going on, helping the supply chain build up around this so that the skills and the tools that are needed to make this industry work, we show what's needed and people come with ideas and go, I could do that. And you go, right, go do that then. So we're very much a shop window for making this stuff visible to people. And that is important because it helps the industry grow as quickly as possible.
So a couple of things you're doing is you're making it visible, because when it's visible, people get excited about it. And the other thing is you're supplying anybody who has a way to potentially make it happen with a grid-connected lab.
Yes, exactly that. Exactly that. And that lab aspect is important as well, because it's not just a case of, you know, does this thing work, which is the first stage. You know, does it? Can you install it? Is it reliable? Does it do what it says? In time, we know that other people are going to make other machines. And at some point, a banker is going to be presented with a project, or a landowner is going to be presented with an idea for a project, so wanting to do this thing in that bit of real estate off their coast. And they're going to have to make a choice as to which machines they put in the water. So at some point, somebody's going to have to take a judgment and say, this machine is better than that machine. This is going to pay back my money before that one does. I'll buy these. And so what we are absolutely determined and we'd be set up to do is to evaluate the performance of these machines, to give people effectively a performance certificate, which shows what those machines did under those conditions. So we are set up as a testing laboratory. We're the world's only testing laboratory for wave and tidal energy machines. We are accredited to the UK accreditation standards. And I can prove to you, when I say it's 3.4, I can prove to you to a very boring number of decimal places that it really is 3.4, not 3.41 or 3.5. We can tell you that number is accurate, so that when investment decisions are taken, they'll be taken in full knowledge of the likely performance of those machines.
When Orbital Marine Power's machine was creating 2 megawatts of power, and that represented 7% of your power, that tells me 28 megawatts is what the islands use?
Yeah, in electricity, yes. It's that sort of order. I think our peak is something like 35 megawatts at peak time. The math doesn't quite work like that, because it was actually 7% over a week. At some points, it was actually 25% of the power requirement. So probably during the night, it's probably about 8 megawatts peak. Yeah, it was down to about 8 megawatts when they were generating. It's that sort of thing. It's a.
Yeah, the load profile is not the same throughout every hour. But I do have questions about the energy. I know I'm getting nerdy here, but does it load follow? Is there intermittency or is it consistent?
Okay, so it's not consistent, because it's driven by the sinusoidal motion of the effect of the moon going around the Earth and the Earth going around the Sun. So there is a very sinusoidal output of energy. So when the tides come in, they stop and they go out again. So when they stop, there's no movement. You know, so there are periods when there's no generation. So the generating profiles are that they probably generate for about 4 out of every 6 hours. So that's okay. But it's very predictable. I could tell you when the tides are going to be generating 1,000 years from today. So in terms of dispatchable.
Excellent. Yes.
You know when it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So that's good.
It would be great to pair it with some sort of energy storage. Because together you can predict how much you need and how much you're going to get.
Yeah. And exactly that. And also, it's not just the storage, it's also the intelligent use. So it may well be, we're all going to have cars, they're all going to be electric, they're all going to be varying sizes of batteries. But I'm sure that we're going to end up realizing that it's going to be spring tides tomorrow, and we get to a point where all the cars get charged because they know that it's going to be less tides in a week's time or something.
So, yeah, and through price or through people just behaving themselves.
Yeah.
Or turning things off, you ensure that when you're not getting energy from that equipment, you are not charging vehicles.
Absolutely right. Yeah. So it's going to be intelligent charging, as opposed to it having to be constant. So this mantra about you require constant power, I just think is really false. You know, you don't have constantly growing wheat. Well, you usually grow it in the time when it's right to grow it, and then you put it in a barn and you eat it during the winter. You know, that's how that works. So we're used to intermittency of supply of other things, but we seem to have this obsession that electricity has to be constant. No, it has to be sufficient, and it can be variable.
Yeah, you can
be smart about load as well as smart about generation.
Absolutely right. Yeah. And we're doing a bit of work on that here at the moment. So there's two things going on. One, because the grid is quite small here, we found that we couldn't get all the energy that we were harvesting, all the electricity we were harvesting, off the island to export it. So we've put a 0.5 megawatt electrolyzer in, so we are able to produce around 230 kilograms of hydrogen in a day if we run the electrolyzer full. And we're using that hydrogen locally, initially to provide auxiliary power for some ferries. But the objective is that we will use the hydrogen to propel the ferries. And that's a piece of work that's going on at the moment. So I think it's tomorrow or Friday, we've got a minister coming up. We're unveiling something about hydrogen. That's all going on. So this is very contemporary. So we're doing things about this now. So we've already got hydrogen being used to power ferries when they tie up at night. We're about to be taking hydrogen on the ferries to run auxiliary systems. And the next stage is to get a ferry constructed to run on hydrogen. And that hydrogen will be green hydrogen. We're having none of this steam methane reforming stuff. It's absolutely going to be electrolysis.
Well, to keep this from being a two-hour interview, I won't go down. I won't go down the hydrogen trail.
Yeah, okay.
But I do think hydrogen is potentially an exceptional way to store energy.
Yeah.
And I'm just very interested in how you're finding the electrolyzer experience, and do you think costs of that will come to a reasonable price?
Well, yeah, we know they will, because from our own experience, we bought our electrolyzer about 3 years ago, and if I bought the same one now, it'd be a quarter of the price. So, and it hasn't stopped going down that curve yet. So we know that's going to happen. We know new materials are going to be brought in, so it won't have to be platinum or other exotic catalysts. We're absolutely sure there will be nanotechnologies and or graphene or something. There will be other ways, molecular sieving ways of getting hydrogen. We're absolutely sure of that. And so it's going to come.
In the U.S., it's kind of interesting that we have a lot of cities and states really helping to propel smart energy forward, smart energy policy. But the U.S. government doesn't necessarily believe in climate change. I don't want to accuse the entire government, but certainly we've lost a lot of momentum as a nation. How has the government here been?
It's interesting. We've effectively got a bit of a federal system, as you have, but on a smaller scale. So here in Scotland, the Scottish government has been very, very driven by increasing renewables targets for some time. I think it's because the weather here is so bad sometimes that there's plenty of wind and there's plenty of water and there's big waves and there's strong tides, and so energy is an easier picture. But we've also had North Sea oil, so we've got quite a big part of our economy is driven from the oil side, and we can see the end of that as that turns down. So there's been a need to diversify and find something else, and because they're aware of energy, renewables has been a suitable vehicle. But I'm also pleased to say that the UK government has also done quite a number of things that has helped renewables really drive forward. So there were tariffs which were available to help small individuals put in small wind turbines, put in solar panels, take on electric vehicles. So there's a number of incentives at a UK government, a governmental national level, and they were all very effective. The UK government energy policy at the moment had been founded very much on nuclear and fracking, but also offshore wind. The fracking is now being looked at slightly sceptically, and people are realising there probably isn't as much shale as they thought there was. And nuclear, the prices for nuclear, which were recently agreed in a long-term contract with China and France, was about £98 a megawatt hour. Offshore wind is now delivering at about £55 a megawatt hour. So the nuclear idea is looking a little less shiny to a number of people. But we are seeing that the government is waking up to the fact it has to do something. So it's now mandating that all new houses have to be equipped with an electric vehicle charge point. That's being introduced in a year or so's time.
That's very exciting.
It's, so you're seeing these signs of these people of waking up and realizing we can do this, but it does require governmental intervention to do certain things to push the market, nudge the market, saying, I don't want any more argument. You're going to do that. Get on with it.
California has 100% net zero energy policy kicking into effect pretty soon, but they don't have the EV part yet that I know of.
Okay.
If anybody's listening and you know that they do, let me know about it. But I don't. But it would be great if they had that.
Yeah, and it's such a no-brainer because it takes so little effort for the builder to leave enough space on the circuit board and to make sure there's a cable route out to the driveway and make sure there's a duct through the concrete drive so you can put the charge point in one day. And indeed, it's actually cheaper for the builder to put the charge point in then and there and add $200 to the cost of the house.
Cheaper for the customer, to get it done then. I say you need two because I have two.
I'm sure you're right.
Can you talk about your background prior to EMEC?
Yeah, so I'm a civil engineer by training, and I started my career in a local government, working in a small local council, working on roads and sewers and drains and footpaths and all the sort of the small scale stuff that councils often have to deal with. And then I was always interested environmentally in things. Going back to the TV program getting me fired up, and
yes,
I'd organised paper recycling collections at college and all this sort of stuff. And I got an opportunity to move into the county council, which is the bigger council, working on waste management. So landfill sites and recycling centres and legal aspects. And then in 1992, I woke up one morning and found there'd been an announcement by the government at the time at the Rio Earth Summit that the UK government was going to form the most powerful environmental regulator in the world. And that then gave rise to an organisation called the Environment Agency. And my piece of the council was being transferred into this new organisation. Oh, okay. So over time...
That was good luck for you.
It certainly was. It was great. And the agency was set up. I can't remember when it was now. I don't remember the date. 96-ish, I think. I forget the date now. And I ended up in middle management. But all the time, I was scuba diving. That was my thing. And I came up here to Orkney from my home, which my home was 750 miles away. This is now my home, but my home was 750 miles away. We came up on a diving holiday to dive some really important shipwrecks that are here, that are left over from the First World War. And whilst I was here, I saw the potential for what I saw as a tidal energy scheme, because there had been some causeways built between some islands that had stopped the tide in 1944. And I could see that the tide was higher on one side of the causeway than the other. And I thought, well, we could put a turbine in here and let the water go through the turbine and generate power. So that was my big idea. But unfortunately, we've not really been able to quite make it work yet. But in my act of trying to make this scheme work, I came across EMEC when it had been created and some of the people involved in it. And I was eventually asked to come and manage. So that was 14 years ago yesterday I started.
Congratulations.
I never thought I'd survive this long, or indeed we would survive this long. But
14 years is a long time.
It is. And there were three people in the company when I joined, and there are now over 50. And the point is that in a community of 20,000 people, 50 reasonably paid jobs, doing good professional stuff, meeting people like yourself who come through our orbit on a continuous basis, fascinating visitors who come with stories from elsewhere and take a little piece of our story away, is such a privilege of a job. It's great. Best job in the world.
I loved it when I was involved with renewable energy and when I was advancing the grid. That was the most exciting time in my career.
We're so fortunate to be starting from a place where we've got so much of this stuff here. So we have got a lot of this technology. We have got electricity. We have got batteries. We have got cars. We've got all this stuff. And luckily, we're waking up to the fact that we have an end of oil within sight. And we can sort this out before it all goes dark and cold. You know, because trying to make a new energy system by the light of a guttering candle is kind of hard. So we do have an opportunity now to make a change in our energy system. And I think we're so fortunate having the opportunity to do that. How many people get a chance in their careers to make these sorts of changes? It's huge.
I feel very fortunate to be here talking to you, as a matter of fact.
That's very nice of you to say so.
No, very fortunate. Do you want to talk about setbacks? You talked about the causeway tidal imbalance and not being able to get energy out of that. That sounds like a setback, but do you want to talk about that or other ones?
Yeah, I can talk about some other stuff. Some of the setbacks we have had have really been when people have put their heart and soul into some of these devices, these wave or tidal energy machines, and they've just not been able to get it to commercial success before the money runs out. And that's such a shame, because they've put everything into it, often put their houses on the line, and you know they've put a huge amount of emotional effort in, and they've put their lives on hold and really made things happen. So organisation, I mentioned the first wave energy machine that generated here, Palamis. Eventually that company was renamed, but eventually went into receivership. And that was such a shame, because the technology worked. And they'd been at sea for a number of years doing a variety of things safely. And that's a non-trivial win, to do things safely at sea in this hard environment without injuring people is a real testament. But they just ran out of financial backing before it took off. And we've seen a couple of these things happen. So other companies have got to the point of success. And then there's been a change in management at some high level, and people have gone, why are we doing this? Oh, stop doing that. And it's been one of those sorts of decisions that has just really killed these technologies. And that's happened several times. And that I find that tragic. It just, and wrong. But I'm not the one who's trying to put up the hundreds of millions of pounds to make this stuff work. So I get that. But we will look back and go, what did we do there? Really? It's a bit like, I'll get slightly political, it's about when GM gave up the EV1 and went for the Hummer. You go, really, what was going on?
So I know a lot of CEOs of companies that have tried to start their own thing, entrepreneurs. Many of them are still making it. Some have made it and some failed to make it.
Yeah.
Most of them talk about the money valley, the lack of money, as being their most difficult thing in their company.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's referred to here as the valley of death. It's that point between you prove the prototype, but you haven't yet got the product. And between those two, that's really hard, because you've still got R&D to do. Often your costs are continuing to go up because you suddenly see that the prototype had got some faults in it you need to fix, and you need to do it slightly better. And you do it better, and you get faster at doing it, but the cost probably goes up a bit while you're doing that. And eventually you get to a point where the scale of repetition means that you're starting to make this stuff, and the cost starts to come down. But to get to that point, you've got to put a lot of... If you're a princess, you've got to kiss a lot of frogs. You know, you have to do a lot of these things. And often it's very much driven by a thing called the learning rates. I don't know if you've come across that as a concept. It's quite interesting. So what it basically means is, if you do something and you do it twice as often again, it'll get better.
Yeah, like an 18% improvement. There's a law, Swanson's law.
Yeah. So there'll be an improvement by an amount. It may be umpteen percent. And if you double it again, so to two machines, to four machines, to eight machines, and 60, each time you double it, you'll get better, and you'll get better by the same sort of percentage. Now, those technologies, different technologies have got different percentages at which they move. And you've got to find out, you've got to discover what your technology's percentage is. And it'll be this for wind turbines, and that for solar panels, and this for nuclear reactors. They tend to go up. But the other ones, all these technologies.
I think Moore's law is 18 months for CPU speed.
Yeah.
I think Swanson's law is for manufacturing benefit.
Yes, I'm sure you're right. And it's that. So that you get better by doubling the amount of effort. But the point is, you need to get to several thousand machines before you start to squeeze those last few percent out. And at several million pounds a machine, that's a hard ask.
They also run out of life steam. Okay, what do I mean by that? There are people that have put 10, 15, 20 years into a technology or a set of technologies. And after a while, they run out of gas.
Yeah.
Or they run out of sun.
Yes. That does happen. And also, as these technologies get to a point where they start to become products, you need to stop inventing things. You just need to make them better. And sometimes that's quite hard. So the people who invented stuff, when I keep inventing things?
Yeah, sometimes they have to let it go to somebody else.
Absolutely
to take
right.
it forward.
Absolutely right. And that's very hard for people to do. So, but it has to happen to everybody.
Yeah, a lot of venture firms will, one of the ways they'll judge a CEO is whether they're able to let go at the right point in time.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And that is definitely a trait that we've seen in people, which makes it difficult for them to let go. And when they do have to let go, that also is quite hard. But often we've seen these people come back and doing something else in a similar sort of space. And that re-energizes them. But yeah, it's difficult to let go. I'm thinking, I've been doing this job for 14 years. I don't know what you're telling me here.
No, I don't think you are. You seem like you are ready to keep going hard for another 14.
Well, I'm sure everybody thinks that. Yeah, I'll just stop one day. But anyway, we'll see when.
Can you talk about the successes that you are most proud of?
I think there are several successes I've been really proud of. One, I mentioned earlier about the Orbital Marine side of things, about them generating 7% of Orkney's electricity. That was just great. We were really very impressed by an email we got one day, which effectively was from Microsoft saying, "Hi, we'd like to work with you." And luckily, the person who got that email, because it just came into our info@emec.
Sometimes those go to junk.
Absolutely right. You think, have you got a Nigerian prince you want me to talk to as well? And when we looked into it more, and that then eventually gave rise to the Naval Group, which is a French engineering group, coming here with a project for Microsoft, which is we've got a data center sitting on the bottom of the sea out at our wave site, which is using the cold water of the North Atlantic to cool it, rather than burning coal to make electricity, to make a refrigeration plant run with all those inefficiency steps to make coal. They're just sticking it in cold water.
I'm working with a company that makes liquid cooling for CPUs.
Okay.
So not the same thing, but somewhat related.
Yeah, a different sort of scale. It's fundamentally the same thing. But there, that was great because they wanted to work with us. And that was, yeah, that was quite a buzz being asked by Microsoft to work with them.
So yeah, that's great.
So that was good. And the reason that was important was it really was an endorsement of all the work we've put in to build a company that is organized and is reliable, and quality systems are there so that when we say we'll do something, we'll do it, and we'll do it to the best of our abilities, and it'll be on time and all that stuff. So that was a sort of a very much a personal endorsement of all the work that all my team have put in over the years to build a company of a caliber that a company like Microsoft were happy to work with. And that's really big. That's a great endorsement, really.
It is.
It's better than your mum just patting you on the head and going, "Oh, well done, son." You know, that was nice. We enjoyed that.
Although having a parent saying "well done" can be very motivating, especially to a child's psyche.
Yeah, absolutely. Right at the right moment. And I think that also that's really the other major success I think we've had was that we recently got a project through the UK government called the Reflex Project. And the Reflex Project is about putting flexibility into a renewables-dominated grid. And that's been a £28 million project that UK government was willing to fund here in Orkney, which will involve putting in battery storage in houses and in industrial settings, but also bringing in another 500 electric cars, which is a trebling of the electric cars that are here on the island, and putting in a hydrogen fuel cell and a whole load of things that glue together all the different things that have been talked about in Orkney. And we're willing to fund a project, or 50% fund a project anyway, to really make this stuff happen. So building the energy system of the future by using all these parts. And for them to give that the credibility to the companies who are engaging in that, that's a real buzz as well.
And maybe we can get it from being the energy system of the future to being the energy system.
Yeah, absolutely right. It needs to become the new normal.
What do you see for the Earth in 20, 30, 40 years?
Well, I really hope we've sorted this climate change thing out, because if we haven't, we are really, really, you can insert your own expletive at that point, screwed really, because we've got to sort this out. We don't have the time. So I absolutely think we will probably end up realising that we need to put a lot of solar into the equatorial areas where it's sunny. We will probably be producing hydrogen or hydrogen derivatives from solar.
And so it's not one or the other. It's not wave tidal or solar.
No. It's what's right in that place. So we're probably going to end up with wave and tidal in areas which are particularly and ideally suited to it. So the west coast of Chile, for example, huge coast, massive wave exposure, going to make sense to put wave energy in there, doing something, helping mining or whatever it's going to be. But in Morocco, there aren't any waves, in which case it'll be solar. You know, so it's working out what are the right things. So we'll have a system where the idea of burning oil will be as mad as it would be deciding to send a child up a chimney to clean it, as it is to us now. Don't do that. We used to, but we don't do it now. I think we'll have made that change. And oil will be seen as a precious commodity. I also think we'll be in a position where we're much more efficient in what we're doing in terms of not losing materials and just frittering them away. We'll have to be more efficient. It'll be interesting to know what we have done in terms of population. The present growth rates are not sustainable. Something is going to change. I don't know what, and I hope we do it in a rational way, but I genuinely worry about that.
Is there anything else you want to say about the future?
I wish I was going to see more of it.
Me too. Me too.
There'll be an end point. And so I think the deal is really, just try and make it slightly better when you leave as it was when you turned
up. That's all we can do, right?
Well,
that's all
we can do. Basically.
Yeah. Do you have any questions for me?
I'm interested in your podcast and if you think there is a sort of a common theme that's coming out, because obviously you're talking to people who are aware of and are motivated by climate change. But is there anything you're seeing really that we can take here in Orkney that we need to take from the other inspiring people you've spoken to?
I think anytime I'm asked that, I would come up with a different answer. But what popped to my head right now, because you talked about how it might maybe inspire you, is most of the people I talk about an urgency,
yeah,
a need to no longer worry about getting everybody on the boat.
Yeah.
We have enough people on the boat. People are where they are. It's time to start sailing hard.
Just go do it.
Go do it.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, that's fair enough. That very fits with our ethos here. Well, what we reckon is, yeah, go do it. But tell people what you're doing. It's not a secret, and it's not... We're not insular, but it's just we're going to get on with this. And if you want to come and join us, carry on. But if you've got a better plan, we'll look at your plan. Maybe we'll take your plan on. I don't mind. But let's just do something.
I think it's really important to make it visible, yeah, like you said, because even if people believe in it, seeing it makes them feel it.
It's a huge difference. It's a very visceral thing. Human beings need to feel this. That's why we've got so many words for emotion, and they're all about feeling. It's tactile, it's experiential, it makes a huge difference. We've had people come here and go, oh yeah, well yeah, of course we do. Yeah, why didn't we think of this before?
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think so, other than the fact I'm going to go and listen to the rest of your podcast.
Excellent. Yeah. I need more listeners. So I'm going to wrap this up, and I'm going to do it with a rap. So who was it that put Neil on the hook? It was my tour guide, Mark Cook. The thing I thought was especially fab was that you've created a grid-connected lab. I'm amazed about all this fantastic tech. I'm glad I visited EMEC. The secret to the waters you're trying to decode. I'm glad I talked to Neil Kermode. The planet he is trying to save, he's using tidal and wave. I really did appreciate the bit when you talked about energy being alternate. Until it isn't, everything seems fine. You quoted the book, This Changes Everything by Naomi Klein. It isn't a fight between water and sun. You're just trying to find another solution and you've tried 31. It might be 200 pounds per megawatt hour, but it's coming down thanks to orbital marine power.
Wow. Very impressed. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Since my discussion with Neil, Scottish floating tidal developer Orbital Marine Power has been awarded £3.4 million from the Scottish Government's £10 million Saltire Tidal Energy Challenge Fund. Orbital Marine Power is the first recipient of the fund, which supports the development of tidal energy in Scotland by driving innovation and cost reduction. The funding will be used to deliver their next generation 2-megawatt floating tidal turbine, mentioned by Neil, which will be built in Scotland and installed at the European Marine Energy Center in Orkney. If you have comments or questions about the podcast, visit my website at www.privatenergyinnovations.com and drop me an email. I would love to hear from you. And if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars if you're an Apple user, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. And if you're in San Diego and want to trade your concern about climate change for a few hours of some great laughs, most weekends I'm doing improv comedy at either the Old Town Improv Company or Finest City Improv or both. Contact me to confirm specific show dates. And if you want a release from some of life's stress or just to improve your speaking skills, consider taking a workshop at an improv club in your town. Neil first came to Orkney on a holiday as a scuba diver to dive the wrecks of Scapa Flow. He quickly discovered that it is a community keen to embrace innovative, sustainable energy initiatives. When EMEC's first managing director left to take up a new position, Neil was in the right place at the right time to help out on a caretaker basis, eventually taking over the helm long-term and has overseen the deployment of more marine energy technologies in the seas around Orkney than has been deployed at any other site in the world, leveraging wave and tidal energy to mitigate climate change.